Thanks for joining us at Cults to Consciousness. This storytelling podcast is meant to be for entertainment purposes only and does not substitute for any medical advice. We may discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health a priority. Lastly, the opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the host.
This is how manipulative the pastor, Bruce Goddard, is of this entire situation. He manipulated me the night I told him, because he said, if we call the authorities, you're going to lose your school, your Christian school. You're going to lose the bus ministry you work in. We could lose the church. So you're instantly guilted into silence. You are blamed for everything. So you're blamed for them leaving. You're blamed for what happened because you're the girl. So somehow you seduced them. He told my parents that the deacons voted to not call the authorities. Then he tells the deacons the authorities have already been called. Mm-hmm. You just have to decide if we tell the church.
Hey, my name is Shalise Ansola, and this is Cults to Consciousness, where we discuss leaving high-demand religions or organizations and finding healing and independence through awareness and true individual sovereignty. If you're only listening and you want to see our faces, you can go to our YouTube channel at Cults to Consciousness. It always means so much when you're writing those words of encouragement for our guests. They do read the comments, and it helps boost the algorithm so more people can become aware of these dangerous groups and start taking a stand against them. So today's guest, this is going to be a second part. We've already had her on to tell the first part of her story. Don't worry, we will fill in the context in case this is the first video you're watching. You don't have to go back and watch the first one, but you can if you want additional context. So in the first episode, we're focusing on the IFB, the Independent Fundamental Baptist Group. This is a guest who was on Let Us Pray documentary on HBO Max, or I think they go by Max now. And it really talks about how these survivors, these victims of assault, were silenced within the church, pushed aside, victim blamed. Really, really awful things, guys. And so we really want to shine a light on what is going on in these groups, what is still continuously going on, and with our guest story specifically, how she was able to get justice after 30 years. And we're going to get into more of the weeds of her story since we did kind of cut it off at a middle point. So before I say any more, let's just bring her on. Thank you so much for joining us, Kathy Durbin.
Thank you for having me again.
Yay! We were talking for about an hour and a half, and I was like, oh my gosh, there's still so much to get through, and I didn't want to rush through the end. So I'm so happy that you're willing to come back and share the rest of your story.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so the first episode, tell me if I miss anything, but we really dive deep into your upbringing, what it was like, the rules of the IFB. The first, I would say 20 minutes, really get into detail as far as what you had to go through and the rules that you had to live by. And also the specific school that you were sent to for a year that was basically like a prison camp. All of the horrible treatment that you received there. And then once you got out, really being preyed on by someone within the church who was also in a teacher at the school, correct? The IFB school?
Correct.
Okay. And so where we left off, you had been consistently assaulted by this man. He was taking advantage of you. You went in and finally said, okay, this is enough. I need to tell somebody about this. And then you were blamed and shamed for it. So I think where we stopped is you were having a conversation with the preacher's wife, and I don't know if conversation is even the right word. It seemed from what you were telling us that she was just yelling at you and calling you all of these names for tempting him or for doing the wrong thing when it was absolutely not your fault. So I'll just give you the floor to take it from there.
Yeah, it was definitely not a conversation. It was just Pastor Goddard wanted to go talk to both Paul Fox and his wife, I guess, and my parents. He just had me sit with his wife, and she felt apparently that it was her responsibility to chastise me. So she basically just called me every name, dirty name in the Bible, you know, whore, harlot, homewrecker. How could you do this and ruin someone's marriage? And I think I said this when we recorded before, but I think the biggest emotional response that I can remember about that time is this huge amount of relief I had felt when I had finally told Pastor Goddard what was happening. It was like, oh, finally someone knows. I don't have to deal with this anymore. I knew I was going to be somewhat in trouble. I did not know I was going to get entirely blamed, but just the fact that it was done was so relieving to me. And then within minutes, an hour, I don't know how long after I was talking to him, he had me go sit with his wife, but it was like, I'm now being ripped up one side down the other for having ruined someone's marriage. And I just remember going from total relief to instant regret on why did you tell? Mm-hmm. Oh my God, you should have not told. What did you do? And I just knew it was like the biggest mistake I had ever made was coming forward about being abused.
Right. And you were 15 or 16 when this happened?
I had just turned 17 when I told.
But it had been going on for a while.
Yep. So it started when I was 15. It was actually before... It was the summer, fall of when I was 15. Then the following May, I turned 16. And then the following May, I turned 17. And this was June 3rd. And so May 24th is my birthday. So this was May 3rd or June 3rd. So I mean, it was like literally a week and a half, 2 weeks after I turned 17.
Yeah.
I just remember thinking I should not have said anything. I should have just let it keep happening because this was going to be way worse than what I thought it was going to be. Pastor Goddard came home a couple hours later, or maybe an hour later. I don't know. I kind of feel like time stood still during that time. And he came in and he told me to come outside onto the balcony. It's probably midnight, 1 in the morning. And my stepdad is out there and my mom is by the car and my stepdad yells, "Get in the car." And I'm like, oh my God. I remember Pastor Goddard said, "I have one more thing I need to ask you." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "Are you pregnant?" And I said, "No." I had no idea. I didn't even know how you get pregnant. Mm-hmm. We weren't taught sex ed. It's not something that is taught in these religions. You're not taught sex ed. You're taught purity. You're taught modesty.
Abstinence only.
Yeah. So you have no idea how the body works. You have no idea how people actually get pregnant. I just remember being so embarrassed about him asking me that. But looking back, that's how I know he knew we had sex, because he literally asked me if I could be pregnant or if I was pregnant. Mm-hmm. And so for him now to say, "I didn't even know you had sex," is just a flat out lie. Because if you didn't think we did, why would you ask that? That makes no sense. Mm-hmm. I was taken home by my mom and my stepdad. Nobody said anything. I just went to bed when I got home. We had 2 days left of that school year. And of course, we went to school at the church. I normally would drive myself, but my mom dropped me off at school. And I remember just hanging around with the teenagers. And then we go into school. We say our pledge to the Bible, pledge to the flag, pledge to the Christian flag. And then we sit down. And I don't remember who it was, but somebody came up to me and said, "You're supposed to go to Pastor Goddard's office." I said, "Oh, okay." So I go to Pastor Goddard's office, which is pretty much right outside the school room. It was like this corner of a garage. But across this little, what would be a driveway, I guess, was another like double wide, which is where our school was. So I went out, came down the stairs, went over by his office, knocked on the door. He said, "Come in." And then he was just like, I said, they said, "I need to come here." He's like, "Yeah, you're not going to school." And I'm like, "Oh." He's like, "We're going to talk in here." And so we sit down and I'm like, "Okay." I don't know what he asked me. I have no recollection of much about those next 2 days, but I spent 2 days in his office. He would say stuff, but then a lot of it didn't make sense. So my big thing was I wanted to talk to Paul Fox.
Yeah. Your abuser, right? That's his name.
Because I wanted him to know why I told, because I felt like at that time I loved him. Like a father, I loved his wife and their boys. And so I wanted to tell him why I told. So I said, I want to talk to him. And Goddard said, no, you can't talk to him. Treat it like a death.
Oh.
And then I was like, what? I did not know what that meant. I had never lost a family member. So I had no, I just did not know what he meant by that. Now I feel like he meant just pretend he doesn't exist because you're not talking to him ever again. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know what that meant at the time. It was confusing to me. I remember there was a lot of phone calls that day. He talked to Dr. Hiles. He talked to Charlie Craze. They both owned Christian Law Association. So his partner, I guess. But David Gibbs was out of town at the time. So Charlie Craze is the one that dealt with my abuse. I know he talked about getting a emergency deacons meeting together and just he would come in and out. He would talk to me some. He would make me play preaching tapes. So like for 2 days, it was either him talking to me or preaching tapes playing. And I was in his office. I wasn't allowed to be at school. And then after school would be over, his wife would take me home and drop me off. And I just remember thinking she was trying to be nice and be like, oh, so how was your day and whatever. And I just remember thinking, what? Like, you just literally lit into me last night and mm-hmm. now you're going to be nice. Like, it was so confusing to me. And when I got home, I had a list of chores I had to do. So we had a horse and I had to paint the tack barn. We lived on an acre and our house was kind of on a hill in the corner of it. So I had to weed the hill all the way around our house. I just had this list of things I had to do. And when I came home from school, my entire room was destroyed. Everything had been gone through. There'd be like school pictures where Paul Fox was cut out of it. I think they were looking for anything that had to do with him or anything that any picture he was in. They didn't take the whole picture. They just cut him out of the picture, which I was like, okay, I still know he was in the picture. It just seemed weird. And I still, to this day, have pictures, like class pictures that he's in and stuff. So I'm not really sure what they were looking for or whatever, but I had to clean that up. I was definitely in trouble. Like, I knew I was in trouble. I don't remember having a conversation at all with my mom or my stepdad about it. I do remember, I think it was Saturday of that week, because I got through those next 2 days. And then Saturday, I believe it was Saturday, could have been one of the evenings. I have no, like, my memory is very spotty in that time frame. Mm-hmm. And I think just because I had been through this trauma, you know, and so I was just surviving. But there was a call and it was Charlie Craze and he asked to talk to me. So my mom talked to him first and then he talked to me and he asked me, do you want to press charges? And I said, no, I love him, but I want to talk to him. And he's like, well, you can't talk to him. And if you press charges, we're not representing you. We'll represent him because we don't represent laymen. We represent pastoral staff. So my mom gets on the phone and talks to him. And I think she said she wanted to press charges. But if you think about this, this is the defendant's attorney. It would be like someone assaulted you and their attorney is calling you.
Yeah.
So it's complete was like witness tampering, basically.
Yeah.
But my mom talked to him. I think she said yes, that she wanted to press charges. And he said, well, we won't represent your daughter. We will only represent Paul Fox because he's the pastoral staff and we only represent church and ministers. So we're going to make your daughter look like she seduced him and blah, 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 whatever.
Wow.
So then they didn't want to press charges. Over the next 2 days that we had school, I just was like basically kept really busy. Well, unbeknownst to me, I found this out later, Bruce Goddard had gone to Paul Fox. And when Bruce Goddard went to Fox the night I came forward, he told him what I was accusing him of. And he admitted it. He said, yes, we have been having sex. And Goddard goes back sometime to Fox and says, We, as the church, will rent you a U-Haul. If you will leave the state within 24 to 48 hours, we will not call the authorities. So Pastor Goddard made a deal with Paul Fox that if he left and just left the state, he would not call the authorities. So to me, that means you know you were supposed to call the authorities.
Right.
If you're agreeing with him and making a deal with him that if you leave, I won't, that means you know you're supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Because now an argument is, well, he wasn't a mandated reporter, which is not true. He was a mandated reporter as a pastor. That happened in the early 90s, and this was 92. But the fact that he makes this deal with him just proves that he did know what he should have done. The thing that I think is interesting is that throughout this whole process, throughout the next few weeks and months, not my mom, not my sister, not my stepdad, not my pastor, not my pastor's wife, literally no one sat down with me and said, what happened? How did this happen?
Mm-hmm.
How long has this been going on? What exactly happened? Nobody wanted to know anything. It is the bizarrest thing in the world to me. Like, I don't know. It just makes no sense to me that nobody asked for any details or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's so bizarre. But Pastor Goddard told me that they had a deacon's meeting and that the deacons decided they were not going to press charges. As an older adult, I ended up kind of having a grudge against some of the deacons because I was like, oh gosh, if it was your daughter, why wouldn't, you know what I mean? Like, that just makes no sense to me. But what I found out throughout the investigation, because some of these deacons were interviewed by the investigators, what I found out was that that is not what Goddard went and asked them. Goddard held an emergency deacons meeting and he told them, we have already contacted the authorities. You guys just need to decide if we tell the church why they've left. And he did tell the deacons that he had an inappropriate relationship with a teenager. And then we've called the authorities. So it's already been reported, but you have to decide if we tell the church. And it's not till years and years later, the last 5 or 6 years now, that I found out that that is not the conversation he had with the deacons. So looking back from this position, I'm in my 40s, I'm looking back and I'm going, wow, I can see how Goddard manipulated everybody in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
He manipulated me the night I told him, because he said, you know, if we call the authorities, you're going to lose your school, your Christian school. You're going to lose the bus ministry you work in. You're going to lose, we could lose the church. And you're like, no, I don't want that. I want to still work in the bus ministry. I don't want my school to go away. So you're instantly guilted into silence. You are blamed for everything. So you're blamed for them leaving. You're blamed for what happened because you're the girl. So somehow you seduced them. And then he told my parents that the deacons voted to not call the authorities. Okay. Then he tells the deacons the authorities have already been called.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to decide if we tell the church. So this is how manipulative the pastor, Bruce Goddard, is of this entire situation. All these years later, having all the pieces now fitting in this puzzle, Goddard manipulated everybody in the situation to get the outcome he wanted, which was for this to all quietly go away and no one to really know about it. Very limited people to know about it.
Do you think it was just to save face so that there wasn't any headlines about the church, so the congregation didn't know about it? What is his end goal? Is it just his reputation?
Yeah, I think it was definitely to protect the image of the church. But ultimately, what drives that is his paycheck. He gets paid by the church. If people quit coming because they don't think it's safe, the tithes and offerings are not going to be as big, so he's not going to make as much money. So in my mind now, it was all about money. When I got older, like I'd say late 30s, early 40s, I sometimes would look back. So I became a nurse. And I was an emergency room nurse. I have called CPS and APS, Adult Protective Services and Child Protective Services, more times than I can count for different things. So I have had teenagers come in that have been being abused by a family member or a teacher or whatever, right? And I have called the authorities and did the report and done the things that normal people do in these situations. And I remember often thinking like, wow, I wonder what would have, how my life would be different had someone done that for me. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I was much, much older that I was like, well, you know, Goddard was young. He was a young pastor. The church was like 10 years old then. And I made these excuses for him in my mind. Let me backtrack for just a minute. During that time, my sister was dating her high school sweetheart, Victor Montero. Victor was in our youth group. My sister was she's 17, 18 months older than me, but she's 2 years older than me as far as school goes. So she graduated when I was a sophomore. So then I had 2 years left with her in Bible college. I had 2 years of high school left. Well, her and a whole bunch of people that age, but her and Victor went off to Bible college to Hiles Anderson, where everyone from our church went. So when all this came out, my junior year of high school, at the end of my junior year is when all this came out. My sister, having been dating Victor for a very long time by then, he knew how everything got handled. He knew how Goddard moved them out of state, how they didn't call the authorities, how they elected not to tell the church why he left. Like, he saw all of this firsthand, right? 5-6 years later, I want to say in 96, Victor was hired. He had married my sister and he was hired as the youth leader. I think initially he was hired by the church as the, like, not an assistant pastor, but an assistant of some way. Like, he was going to run the bus ministry and help do things. But he ultimately, within a very short amount of time, became the youth pastor. Victor, like most of these guys, are outgoing, fun, just very personable. Everybody's kind of drawn to them because they have that outgoing kind of personality. So here's my brother-in-law, having known exactly how Goddard handled an abuse situation of a staff member with a teenage girl. Okay. So he becomes the youth pastor. I go to Bible college, but I end up coming home after 2 years because my abuser went to my Bible college. Oh, he was at First Baptist Church. I thought it was interesting that he was working in the youth group there. So here is this man that abused me, and now he's working in the largest youth group in the U.S.
Oh.
I'm like, okay, that makes no sense. So I had to see him 3 times a week because when you're in Bible college in Indiana at Hiles Anderson, you have to go to church Sunday night, Sunday morning, and Wednesday night, 3 times. So I would see him 3 times a week. And so I ultimately ended up coming home. Plus, I was on work scholarship, like many of the girls at Hiles, and I was placed in Dean Moore's office to work for him. He was the dean of the evening college, but he was Paul Fox's best friend, one of his really, really good friends. So I thought that was very weird because no freshmen ever get placed in like a higher level staff's office. As a freshman, unless you're the sister of somebody high up in the IFB, you're cleaning toilets or you're working right in the cafeteria or whatever. So here I am working for the dean of the evening college in his office as like a secretary, but his really good friend is my abuser. So it was, that whole thing was really weird. And then also Paul Fox and his wife, when they went back to Indiana, they were really good friends with Jack and Cindy Scott. And they started counseling them. So get this, put these pieces together. Paul Fox systematically grooms me and abuses me. He then gets caught. He moves to Indiana, back to Hiles Anderson and First Baptist Church, where he is good friends with Jack and Cindy Scott. So they get marriage counseling by them. 10 years later, Jack Scott is arrested for doing the exact same thing to a teenage girl that Paul Fox did to me.
Wow.
Were these counseling sessions or were they writing a playbook? I think that is just so weird that there were so many similarities between Jack Scott's abuse of this girl and my abuse by Paul Fox.
Yeah.
And that he had counseled him. I think that's so bizarre. So my brother-in-law becomes the youth pastor and things are fine for like 15 years. There was a lot of behavior by my brother-in-law that would have been not allowed, like squirting girls with hoses, you know, so their clothes, their shirts are wet, tackling a girl to the ground, playing football or something. But everybody would always say, oh, that's Victor. That's his personality. Oh, it's just Victor. And so there was a lot of stuff that was overlooked that was quite obvious. So ultimately, I end up getting, let me say one thing. When I was going through the first couple of days to weeks of, you know, me having told Pastor Goddard what happened and sitting with his wife and all this stuff, I was made to write a apology letter to Paul Fox's wife, Lorraine.
So disgusting.
Yeah, they had me write a letter apologizing for ruining their marriage. At 17. I know. I look back on that and I just think, wow. It's so mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
I'll jump back to my brother-in-law. So Victor's the youth pastor. He's the youth pastor for like 15 years. There's things that go on that are questionable, but they all say, oh, it's just Victor. It's Victor. It's his personality. Oh, it's just brother Victor. In there, I get married. I start having kids. Another reason why you can say that the Independent Fundamental Baptist is a cult is because if you are not in the cult or attend the cult, you aren't in your family's lives. Like our extended families were not really in our lives because remember, you stop going as your, you know, Christmases come up and birthdays that you would normally go to is you're having all these messages every year about how, well, do you really want your kids around Uncle Bob who smokes or do you really want them where there's going to be alcohol? And so you start pulling away from these things that aren't super mandatory to where you're not attending family events anymore. Mm-hmm. Or you've gotten your family to come start attending the church and they are also pulling away. So we weren't super involved with our extended families. So I knew, even as an adult, I attended that church. And if I didn't attend, I would not be able to be in my family's life. So even as a single adult, I attended the church. I didn't go all the time. I didn't go three times a week like you're supposed to, but I did attend. And then when my husband, we got married, we went, I think it was like an Easter or something. My sister and my brother-in-law invited him and he was like, you know, okay. And he would always say like, this kind of feels like a cult.
Wow.
And I would be like, well, I mean, I can see why you would say that, but it's really not. And that's what I would say, like to defend it because I mean, what do you say? This is where I grew up. It's not a cult because you really do not see it until you leave it.
Yeah.
So we started going there. Our kids were going there. I wasn't really bought in anymore as much. I was an ER nurse. I wore pants to work. So clearly I did not abide by all the rules that they followed. But my kids, my daughter did wear skirts and dresses. I wore skirts and dresses when I went to church or went to my mom's house or, you know, anywhere where there was going to be church people there, I did dress the part. But at work, I wore scrubs. So in 2013, my brother-in-law left the church. So In a surprise action, Pastor Goddard got up and announced that Victor and Crystal, my sister, are going to help Pat Cook start a church. So Pat Cook was a teenager that had grown up in our church, went to Bible college, came back. He had married a girl from the church and was working at the church. And so Goddard got up on a Sunday night and announced that those two couples were going to start a church. And this is what happens. This has been the MO. Somebody gets caught doing something or somebody does something wrong. All of a sudden, it's announced that God has called them somewhere else, mm-hmm. or God is leading them to start a church, or they feel God directing them here, there. That's how the pedophile shuffle is done, in a way that nobody suspects anything.
Mm-hmm.
So this was in, I think it was 2013 this happened. In 2018, me and my husband, our kids moved to Montana. In April. In May, a woman who grew up in our youth group came forward to another woman who grew up in our youth group. So April, who was also in the documentary, she came forward to Rachel, who was also in the documentary, to tell them that Victor, my brother-in-law, had abused her when she was a teenager in the youth group. And eventually, Rachel came forward as a victim. Leah, several women came forward as victims of my brother-in-law. He was investigated, ultimately arrested. And within, I think, a matter of like 4 to 5 months, the whole process, he pled guilty and went to prison. During that investigation, my name kept coming up. So I called the investigator. I didn't know that. But I called the investigator at one point and I asked him what was happening. And he wanted to know my story. And I said, "What do you mean my story?" He's like, "Well, everyone I've interviewed has said something about you."
Huh.
And I'm like, "What do you mean exactly?" And I had gotten a little bit of this from April, but I thought when I talked to April, I could have swore she said her, like he kept her quiet using my story. But when I talked to the investigator, Victor used what happened to me to keep all of his victims quiet. So Rachel was really close to her friends. She loved her friends. That's what was important to her. And so he told her, "If you ever tell anyone, you're going to lose all your friends just like Kathy did." And they all knew who I was because I still went to church there.
Right.
And then April was very close to her family. And so he told April, "If you ever tell anyone, if I ever get caught, you are going to be the black sheep in your family, just like my sister-in-law, Kathy." Oh. And so he had systematically used what happened to me to keep all of his victims quiet. And literally every victim I have ever talked to, and there are many, they have all said they knew who I was because Victor had mentioned me.
Oh my
and that
gosh.
Something that happened to me would happen to them.
And was that really the case for what he was saying as far as being ostracized? Did you continue to be punished by your friends and your family for something that wasn't your fault as years went on?
Yeah. So going back to being a junior in high school, it was the end of my junior year when I told Pastor Goddard what was happening and then Paul Fox left. The next year, I was a senior. And we go on a senior trip. And I remember there was only originally 6 of us in our senior class. Remember, we go to this tiny Christian school. So there was 3 boys and 3 girls. So when it came down to our senior trip, only us 3 girls and one of the guys was going. And Pastor Goddard at that time always did the senior trips. He would take the group up the coast, do fun things, whatever. I remember my mom dropped me off at Goddard's house. We were waiting for everybody to arrive. We were going to be going on the senior trip that morning. And I remember him saying to me, "If you can't get that look off your face, you should stay home." And I was so taken aback. Like, what? What? I did not understand what he was saying. I knew I didn't want to be alive. I had cried myself to sleep every single night that year. So now looking back, I can say 100% sure I was depressed. And that was probably the look on my face. But I had no idea what he was talking about. Because in that community, in that cult, mental health, it doesn't exist. You are not allowed to have depression or anxiety. That doesn't exist. If you have a head problem, it's a heart problem. You're not praying and reading your Bible enough. There's literally a sermon that you can find on YouTube where Goddard says, it's a clip, where Goddard says, if they want to jump off the bridge, let them. It'll clean out the gene pool.
Oh, wow.
That is his feeling about mental health. So I was sexually abused from 15 to 17. Cry myself to sleep every night for a year. And when he gets alone with me and I look sad, he says, if you can't get that look off your face, you should just stay home.
Absolutely zero support, zero help, zero therapy, just completely alone at this point.
Yeah. And honestly, there was no compassion or empathy or anything from anyone. Nobody was allowed to know. So it was a huge secret. The people that did know, like my two best friends that were on this trip with me, were no longer my best friends. And it was as if everyone knew I had something to do with the foxes leaving, but they didn't really know what. And so I was blamed, and everybody loved the foxes. They were very outgoing. And so I was blamed. So we go on this senior trip. The girls stay in one hotel room, the boys stay in another. And so we go in the first hotel, and these two girls decide to lock me out of the hotel after all my stuff is in the room.
Oh my God.
So I am locked out of the room all night. I know Pastor Goddard's mad at me because he thinks I have this look on my face that I shouldn't have. So I don't want to knock on his door or call his room and tell him I'm locked outside, because he'll somehow believe it's my fault. Mm-hmm. So I wait till in the morning when we're supposed to be leaving. They open the door when it's time to leave. I run in and grab my stuff. I have no time to shower or anything. I slept in the lobby.
Oh.
Okay. So then I think it was that day. We went to Morro Bay. We were in Morro Bay and we were going to go kayaking on the ocean. Well, the two girls didn't want to go. So the one guy that went in one kayak, and I went in a double kayak with Goddard. So we're kayaking and whatever. And then we come back, and the two girls had drawn a whale in the sand and wrote my name in it.
Oh my gosh, this is so awful.
And this is my senior trip. Like, wow. I am having a miserable time, but I'm trying to not have whatever look I had on my face that he didn't want me to go. Like, there was just so much dynamic there. And I didn't understand any of it because we're not taught about mental health. We're not taught. Everything is to do for everybody else. Give, 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 give. And you're just like, I do not remember knowing what suicide was, but I knew I didn't want to be alive. I knew I didn't want to exist, but I don't remember knowing I could take my life.
Right.
If that makes sense. That was my senior year. And then I went off to Bible college and saw my abuser for 2 years, 3 days a week. And I just was like done. And so I came home. My mom would not pay for me a plane ticket to come home. So my grandparents paid for me a plane ticket. So I ended up living with them, but they still didn't know anything. Fast forward to 2018. Now this woman has come forward, and now there's multiple women. And now my brother-in-law gets arrested. And when I spoke to the investigator during his investigation, he wanted to know what was happening with, you know, what happened to me. I told him, and this whole time I'm thinking, I'm just helping with my brother-in-law's case. Like, I'm helping these women. And me, my husband, our kids moved to Montana in April of 2018, very, very beginning of April. But we had a business we owned in California. So we had already made plans for the first 2 weeks in June to go back down to California to just finish some stuff up and do some things. So we go down there, we're staying at my parents' house, and we get in really late Friday night. I think we landed at like midnight. So by the time we got to my mom's, it was like 1 o'clock in the morning. So we wake up a little bit late and my mom says, well, I'm going to go have breakfast or lunch or something with Mrs. Goddard because I haven't been going to church because everybody wants to talk about what's happening with Victor and Crystal and I don't want to answer questions. So I'm going to go see Mrs. Goddard and blah, 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 blah. And she goes, I don't know if you know everything that's going on. And I said, well, I probably know more than you do because April's attorney has already called me. I had talked to April's attorney because April wanted me to tell them what happened to me because this would be another case of Goddard not taking action.
Yeah.
And so my mom said, well, do you care if I tell Tammy Goddard? And I said, I don't care what you tell her. So she goes to lunch with her. And Tammy says to my mom, you know, with this investigation, Kathy's story may come up. What happened with her? And she goes, Tammy, it already has. Kathy's talked to April's attorney. And this was on a Saturday. Okay, so Sunday night, Goddard does this super short sermon, doesn't do an altar call, which is unheard of in the history of Faith Baptist Church, finishes his sermon and says, anybody that has ever been in our youth group, who works in our youth group or a church, who has a teenager, anybody that wants to come up to the Spanish chapel, we need to have a church meeting. So he goes up there and thank God somebody recorded this call, this conversation. He gets up there and he says, 30 years ago, and I wasn't there, obviously, because we had moved, but I got this from a staff member. 30 years ago, our youth pastor, which Fox was never the youth pastor, but he says, our youth pastor had a relationship with a teenager. So he calls it a relationship.
Oh, wow.
And he says, we called the authorities. We did everything right. We have it all written down if anyone wants to see it, but names have been redacted. So we are cooperating with the authorities and we just want everybody to know because this may come up. Well, he already knows it's come up because his wife told him from her conversation with my mom the day before, right? So my sister-in-law is the church secretary still to this day, but this was 2018. I text Pastor Goddard and I say, I want a copy of this write-up about what happened to me. We're in town and I can come get it from you, or you can give it to Rachel, who's my sister-in-law, and she can mail it to me. I never hear a word because of course he's going to say something's available that's not really available because he expects everyone just to believe him and do what he says and not question him. So if someone were to come actually ask him for it in person, he would probably say, do you not believe me?
Oh my gosh.
Would be, to him, asking for what I'm telling you I have and you asking to see it is you not having, you're not loyal. You're not having faith in what I'm telling you. You think I'm lying to you. So that is the route he would go with that. So I don't think there was anything in writing. So I had lunch 3 days later on a Wednesday. I had lunch with a staff member's wife. And she was my friend and we were talking and I said, I don't know what to do. Like, this is crazy. This whole thing is crazy. My story is getting brought up. You know, this whole thing with Victor and Crystal is crazy. Like, it's crazy. Like, right. How do you navigate this? And she says, well, you know, everything that people are hearing is coming from Pastor Goddard. And I said, right. And I kind of said quietly, but out loud, I need to tell my story.
Mm.
And then I said it again. I need to tell my story. It was like total peace. This is what I needed to do. Because in this time frame, I have found out that what was so hurtful and damaging to me, what happened to me, my brother-in-law was able to use it to do the same thing to multiple teenage girls. And here's Goddard, the pastor of this church lying still almost 30 years later. I think it was around 27 years by this time. Lying about how it was handled.
Yeah.
And to me, that just blew my mind. Because when I heard about what that meeting was about, that that's what he brought up, I knew what this person was going to tell me was that, yeah, he got up and he talked about your situation and he apologized because it wasn't handled right, but they're totally cooperating with the police. Like, that's what I expected.
Yeah.
No, he's lying.
Doubling down.
Lying. And I'm just like, I'm seeing who this man of God is for the first time as an adult with my eyes wide open.
Right.
Like, he's lying? The man of God, this anointed man of God is lying? And he's manipulating people to be quiet? Like, the whole, it was just this mind-blowing experience that this man of God, that you are not supposed to question because they are anointed by God and they're like right under God. You're now seeing them in a completely different light. It's so confusing in your mind. You know, it's like you almost don't want to believe it.
Right.
Because you're just, you feel so duped. Like, I have followed this man for 40 years of my life, thinking he was like right under God, and he's been lying and manipulating, and you just feel really duped, for lack of a better word, because it's just so, you're just so shocked that you could be sucked into something like that.
Well, and on top of that, this betrayal that you're experiencing, I'm sure you were taken back to those feelings that you had when it all first came out, when it all happened to you 30 years before that. How were you handling this emotionally? I imagine it was extremely difficult hearing almost a repeat of your story with all of these young girls.
To me, my situation was very isolated. It was a one-time thing by a man that came to our church that was a bad person, and I happened to be vulnerable, and he got away with it. Hearing that my brother-in-law did the same thing and that he used what happened to me. In my family, I was the black sheep. I knew that. I knew that to be true, even though I wasn't like outwardly called that. There was nothing I could do that I felt like was good enough that my parents were proud of me. And my parents, I'm talking about my mom and my stepdad. There was just not enough that I could do to make them proud. And my sister and brother-in-law were in the ministry serving God. My stepbrother and his wife, she was the church secretary, and he taught an adult Sunday school or worked on a bus route. And I was just home working as a nurse, raising my kids. Like, I always felt like I was not seen as good. A good person, a good Christian. I was never good enough for them. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's what I was always striving for. I started a business. It was very successful. I was an ER nurse. I got trauma certified. I was trying to do all of these things, trying to make my mom and stepdad proud. And I just always lost. I was still the black sheep. I still wasn't good enough. I still wasn't doing enough. And I always felt like it was all because I wasn't involved in the church like I should be, like overly involved in it, you know? But I honestly, even now, I don't think that there was anything I could do, because when I graduated from nursing school, which I put myself through nursing school.
Wow, that's amazing.
Thank you. When I graduated, I threw myself a party. When my sister graduated from hairdressing school, my parents threw her a party.
Okay.
So it's just always been this reminder that you're not as good. And I never understood it. I never understood why my mom and I did not get along and I was never good enough. But in the last year, well, since November, when the documentary came out, one of my nieces called me She texted me and said, can we talk? And so I called her. And she had sent me a beautiful text just saying, I love you and all these things. We talked. And, you know, one of the things she said was that I asked my mom when I was a teenager, why is Aunt Kathy the black sheep in the family? And my mom said, because she was sexually assaulted as a teenager. And she said, that makes no sense, and tried to push further, and they didn't want to talk about it. So she said it's never made sense to her until she saw the documentary, and then she understood. She understood why I was the black sheep and what had really happened. And she's no longer in the IFB, by the way. Her parents are, but she's not. And so to me, that was so validating. It was so validating that this 13, 14-year-old teenage girl whose parents were all sucked into this IFB, she knew I was the black sheep in the family without anyone saying it, but also knew enough to know that answer doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's amazing.
To me, that was so confirming to me, like, just, it was empowering to me that, like, I didn't just feel it. It was a fact, and it was nothing I could control. It was completely out of my hands.
Mm-hmm.
My brother-in-law pled guilty because he's not very bright, and he wrote, I don't know. I think through some of this investigation, I just think, oh my God, are you guys that dumb? How did you get away with what you did? Like, I'll give you an example. So they had arrested him and he was in the interrogation room. Our investigator was freaking amazing. The same investigator that investigated my brother-in-law also investigated my abuser. And he was just phenomenal. He sat my brother-in-law down and became like a friend to him, which I guess a good investigator would, right? And he just said, you know, tell me about your job. Tell me, like, what was it like being a youth pastor? Blah, 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 blah. Oh, that must be hard. Da, 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 da. And he's like, you know what? Let's just take care of this today. Let's just get this taken care of. You know, I know that you're sorry for what you did. And, you know, it makes sense. You know, whatever he said, he played him. And he said, I'm going to give you a piece of paper and a pen. And I want you to write each of these girls an apology letter, a sincere apology.
You know,
be specific about what you're apologizing for. And let's just take care of this today. So of course, my retarded brother-in-law sits there writing apology letters to all his victims.
Detailed confessionals.
Yes.
Oh my God.
And then I'm like, well, what the heck's taking so long? If this goes to trial, this is ridiculous because he wrote the evidence.
Yeah. You
know? Plus they had some recorded phone calls. So he ends up after like 4 months of being in court and different things, he pled guilty. Well, one of the things I had to do because my case was so old, when I filed a police report and they were investigating, the investigator said, would you do a pretext phone call? And I said, what's a pretext phone call? He's like, it's where you call him, meaning Paul Fox. Now, this is from 27 years ago. He's like, you call him and you talk to him about your relationship or what happened to you. And I'm like, what? I'm not understanding what the problem is here. Like, what? I don't understand this. Why am I doing this? Like, he doesn't want to talk to me. I haven't talked to this dude in 27 years. He lives in Pennsylvania. Well, I guess this is an actual thing. If either the crime is really old and they want to make sure the victim's like really wants to follow through with this, or they don't have any evidence, so they're trying to get evidence, one of the ways they can do it is have the victim call the perpetrator and get them talking about it, and they record them. So they're not allowed to just hand over a phone number. They give you like a list of phone numbers, and they also give you, at least mine did, gave me a list of different ruses I could use. So what I did was I said, I'm in therapy because I never got closure about what happened with us. And I have questions only you can answer. And so I really need to talk to you. So basically, I went through the list of phone call of telephone numbers. One of them was his current wife.
Oh, geez.
If you can believe that. I call his current wife and I say, hi, can I talk to Paul Fox? And she says, who is this? And I said, my name's Kathy and I used to go to church with him a long, long time ago. And she goes, I think she asked me like, well, why do you want to talk to him? And I said, I don't even remember what I said. Like, I need to talk to him about something that happened a long time ago, whatever. I don't even remember. I think I ended up telling her that we had a relationship or something, because she asked me if I had kids. And then she also said, well, I guess this is why he'll never talk about his days of being a pastor. And I thought that was weird. Right. And so I call him. She gives me his number and says, oh, she also said that she would try. I don't think she gave me his number. I think she said she would, I can give him the message. That's what she said. So I went to the next number on my list and it happened to be his number and his voice was on the recording. Okay. Keep in mind, we had lived in Montana for a couple of months. This was in the fall and we had moved in April. We live in this valley between two mountains on a highway. And there was one corner of my house, maybe 3 square feet, that you could get a cell phone reception that was good. So the corner of the couch was right there. And I knew this was like a one-time deal. I was not making this phone call twice. I didn't even want to make it to begin with.
Yeah.
So I had my iPad there. One of those like MP3 recorders was laying there and my cell phone. And every time I would go to make the call to him, I'd have my husband take the kids and go get an ice cream or go to dinner or whatever I'm going to try to call. And I did this every night for a week and I would call, I would hit record, and I would call and I would say, hi, this is Kathy. I know it's a blast from the past. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to bug you. I'm in therapy. There's questions only you can answer. Can you please call me back? And this is my number. And so I'd hang up, hit stop, hit pause and rewind. Oh, the other thing I had was a tape player. I had bought a little tape player where you have to put play and record. I'd gotten some tapes. I mean, it was all set up. The kids knew they were not allowed to go in that corner of the couch because it all had to be sitting there. Every time I would go to do it, I would get like, I would feel like I was going to have a heart attack. I'm like, okay, okay, you can do this. Okay. All right. I'd put play and record. I dial on my phone. And so I did this every day for a week. Every time I did it, I would get a little bit more bold. Uh-huh. So by Friday night, my husband had taken the kids somewhere. I call and I say, and by now, his voicemail does not say his name anymore. It's now an automated thing that says, you have reached this number or leave a message. And so I'm like, I know it's still his phone. I mean, to me, that's stupid. But I called and I said, okay, so I'm pretty sure this is your number, but you're not calling me back. And I really need to talk to you. Well, I guess if I don't hear back from you in 24 hours, I'll just call some of your family members in the area. Okay, hope to hear from you soon. Bye. And I hang up.
That'll do
it. So I hit stop, rewind. I hit stop, make sure everything's all set up again. I go sit down. I'm trying to come down from this heart attack that I almost have every time I do it. And my phone rings. And I had him saved in my phone. So my phone rings and I look at it and it's him. And I'm like, oh my God. I run across the room. I hit play and record. I've got like everything on. And then I put my phone on speaker and I'm like, hello? And he's like, what do you want? And I'm like, hi. He's like, hi, what do you want? And I'm like, I'm sorry to bother you. I'm not trying to mess up your life or anything, but I'm in therapy. And I'm like trying to frantically go through my mind about what my ruse was, because I am there's so much adrenaline running through my veins at this moment. And so I tell him, you know, like, I'm in therapy, I'm trying to get closure, and there's just questions only you can answer. You know, I'm sorry to bother you, blah, blah. He's like, well, what? And I said, well, I guess, first of all, did you love me? And he goes, no. He goes, I really cared about you, but I loved my wife and boys. And I'm like, oh. And then I said, well, why me? Out of all the girls in the youth group, why me? Now, if you have any sort of brain cells, you're going to say, well, I didn't pick you, or it just happened, or whatever. No, he goes on to tell me why he picked me in this recorded call. So he's answering questions. And then all of a sudden, a few minutes in, maybe 5 minutes in, he says, well, you know, when we moved from California back to Indiana, I started working for FedEx. I think it was FedEx. He's like, and I fell and hit my head and I don't remember anything. Uh-huh. And I'm like, oh, after he's just talked to me about things, he doesn't remember anything. So he goes on this whole victim mentality thing where he's the victim, blah, blah, yeah. blah. And, you know, Lorraine left me. You know, she believed me for a while, but then she divorced me. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, like whatever. So then we get to the end of the call and he says, you know, I just, you know, if you really want to keep your girls safe, and I didn't tell him that I had girls or a girl or whatever. He just said, if you really want to keep your girls safe, you'll never let them go to church. And I'm like, what? Ooh. He's like, no, really. If you want to keep your daughters safe, don't ever take them to church. And I'm like, okay. And then he goes, maybe we'll talk again sometime.
Oh,
and I laughed like out loud. And he's like, no, really. And I'm like, okay. Like, I was just like, dude, I don't even want to be talking to you right now.
Yeah.
But what was interesting is I asked him about his conversation that he had the night that Goddard came and told him that I had told Goddard that what was happening. He said, oh, well, he just said that you had said we were having sex, I think is what he said. He said, oh, well, he just told me if I leave the state right away, that they won't call the authorities. So I kept that deal. I made that deal and I never talked about it again. So I kept my end of the bargain. That was his verbiage for how he talked about this deal that Goddard made with him. To me, that is a huge picture of how Goddard knew this was a crime and did not report it. And he made a deal with the perpetrator, which in hindsight, I remember I texted my investigator and I said, I did it. And he's like, did what? I made the phone call. He's like, what? No way. Like, I guess people won't do it. But I mean, I had nothing to lose at this point, you know? And so two investigators went to Pennsylvania to, and there's this, I don't know how much you want me to go into this because there's just, it's up to you. You tell me.
Well, I know there's so much to this story and I don't want you to have to cut anything out. So we have about 20 minutes. So as much as you want to say, to let us know what actually ended up happening and then obviously leave time for how you're doing now and how you got out of it.
I guess I'll skip that part. So he ends up getting arrested. They did this investigation. He gets extradited. It takes like 3 weeks. He gets arrested in Pennsylvania. He gets extradited to California. And then they spelled his name wrong. And he went to the federal prison in Riverside because, you know, this was a jurisdictional thing and he could fight extradition and yada, yada. So they went to the federal prison in case there was like a, you know, like federal thing that had to be dealt with. Well, if you go to prison, if you go to jail, if you're arrested, you have to see a judge within 48 hours. If you don't, then they have to let you out and come back for, I forget what they call the first hearing. They spelled his name wrong, so they did not see that he came in on a Monday, and they didn't see that he actually had a court date for his hearing on Wednesday. And so they let him out because they weren't following their own rules, so he would have to, you know, they let him out. Well, they ended up issuing a bench warrant for him to come back. So he was arrested and extradited to California in July. They made his arraignment date October. So first of all, I was kicking myself for not going to California in July and seeing him like in custody, in an orange jumpsuit. Like that was, it was almost like, because I was so separated from it, because I was in Montana, it was almost didn't feel real. Yeah. And even the page that comes out in the paper, the Lake Elsinore Sheriff's Department or Riverside County Sheriff's Office always posts a, you know, this person has been arrested. These are why. It's an open investigation. If you have any information, call this number. And they post their mugshot. Well, he was just in a white t-shirt. So it just, it didn't do it for me. It didn't seem real. I'm over here in Montana. This is happening in California. And so like, I'm like, okay, I got to be there. I got to be there. So I go to court in October for his initial arraignment. And it's literally like a 2-minute thing. They've got like 20 to 30 defendants in this courtroom that quickly get up with their attorney and say what the charges are. And okay, do you want, you know, if we set the trial date or if we set the next date for this, are you waiving your right to a speedy trial? And the, you know, the attorneys are like, say yes, you know, whatever. And so, I mean, it was like such a quick 2-minute thing. And it was like, okay, the next thing was going to be in November. So I flew back home, came back in November. Then there was something in December and I came every time. And at first I came because I needed to see him stand before a judge in a courtroom to make it feel real. Mm-hmm. But then I kept coming and it was important for me to keep coming. And I realized at some point it was important to the 15-year-old me, 15, 16, 17-year-old me that nobody was there for.
Yeah.
I was showing up for her. And to me, that was like so healing to be there for myself as a little girl. I will say this one part of the story that's super important to me. I did not realize that I had been chasing this approval from my parents my whole life, my whole adult life, until the day I got a call from the district attorney's office. And it was a victim advocate. And she said, is this Kathy Durbin? Yes, this is so-and-so. I'm a victim advocate with Riverside County District Attorney's Office. And I had been waiting for the call where they were going to say, we're not pressing charges. I'm sorry. It's been too long. I knew this was not going to go through. I knew, because part of it was the investigator had showed me how the algorithm works for if it can be pushed through, you know, regardless of statute of limitations. And part of it was just, I knew it had been too long. And so, you know, there's no physical evidence. It's by this time, it's like 27, 28 years old. Like, it's not going to go through. So I'm just waiting because I knew the investigation was done and it had all been sent to the DA's office. This was prior to him getting arrested. And so I was just waiting for this call. So I get this call. She's a victim advocate. And she says, we are pressing charges on your behalf. And I'm like, what? And she says, the district attorney's office is pressing charges on your behalf. Do you have any questions? And I said, no. And she said, are you sure? And I said, yeah. And she said, okay, this is my name and number. Write it down. Call me if you have any questions. And I remember I hung up the phone and I sat there and probably 10 times I said, they're pressing charges on my behalf. They're pressing charges on my behalf. And I said it until it finally sunk in. And I said, they think I'm worth justice.
Oh, I'm tearing up over here.
I'm tearing up because I can't not cry about this. It was that moment, or in the very few moments after, is when I realized my entire adult life, I had spent looking for someone to tell me, you're worth it.
Mm-hmm.
You are enough. You are worth whatever. It was in that moment that I realized what Paul Fox took from me was my self-worth. And no. Any part he didn't take, Goddard took the rest by sweeping this all under the rug. So to me, the district attorney's office pressing charges on my behalf, almost 30 years after the crime was a pivotal life-changing moment for me.
Yeah.
I felt like I had worth. They thought I was worth justice. And so, like, literally, that's the day in my life when I realized I had value. Because nobody, no adult in my childhood or in my life had made me feel valued.
Mm-hmm.
And my pastor, of all people that you can think of, did not think I had enough value to get justice, to like call the police because something bad happened to you. Because instead, he would rather keep the reputation of the church and keep his income coming in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's pathetic. It's so disgusting.
Wow. What incredible validation to get that, to hear that phone call.
That was huge.
Is that what really shifted your whole life as far as moving away from the IFB? Or had you already distanced yourself mentally at that point?
It had been coming for sure.
Yeah.
Distance from the environment and from those people is what like takes the filters off your eyes.
Yes.
You start seeing things very clearly. Quickly, you realize, oh shit, I was in a cult. You're like, that is legit a cult. And so it really just takes separation. But to get people to separate is so hard because they all have sucked in so much doing what they think is the right thing. They've left their family, their friends, their jobs, their schools, their anything that's not involved in the cult, they is no longer part of their life. So when they do feel like I should leave, they literally have to make the choice to leave everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so people just aren't willing to do that. Nobody wants to be out there on an island by themselves. And so if you do get that separation, even if it's for 30 days, your eyes, the veils start coming off and you realize you were in a cult. It's crazy.
Isn't it wild how obvious it is once you leave and you can look back and go, oh, wow, how did I not see that? But when you're in it, it's just literally impossible until something, usually it's a big event, an emotional thing. Someone passes away or abuse happens or something that has to kind of jostle you awake for a second.
Right.
And that's what it takes to get you out, is just this emotional moment.
You instantly feel stupid because you're like, how was I sucked into a cult? I'm smarter than that. But it's then you also look at like how good do you have to be at manipulation to get all of these people to follow you? Without question.
Yeah.
Like Bruce Goddard is freaking great at manipulation. Like unbelievably great. It's crazy to me. Something interesting that happened during the whole court process was if you get arrested, you or your defense attorney can make a deal with the district attorney's office. So let's say you have a felony charge against you. You can go and say, okay, well, I'll plead guilty if you make it a misdemeanor, or I'll plead guilty if you say no jail time, right? So you can make a deal. Well, our DA's office was not willing to give Victor or Paul Fox a deal because they said you held a position of authority. You abused minors. Like they were not the district. Riverside County District Attorney's Office is not willing to give pedophiles a deal, which I think is phenomenal.
Yes.
And just a shout out for Jerry Fall, and it's P-H-P-F-O-H-L. He is running for judge this March, so please vote for him. He's phenomenal. He was my district attorney. You can, though, go to the judge and ask for a deal because the judge is an independent person and they can give you a deal. So the day of the preliminary hearing, which a preliminary hearing is where you call in the main witness, which was me, and any other witnesses like the investigator, and they put them on the stand. And then they, until the judge hears enough that they decide, yes, there's enough to go to trial, and they set a trial date, or they say, no, there's not enough. So we're going to dismiss the case. So January 8th was the preliminary hearing, and Paul Fox's attorney decided to go see if the judge would give him a deal. Now, this judge knew nothing about us because we had been in this arraignment court. So this is the first time we're before a trial judge. And this trial judge basically just looks at the two charges that were on him, hears from the DA and the defense argue a little bit until he finally says, okay, this is what I'll offer. And he offered him up to 1 year in jail, 2 years probation, registered sex offender for life. He took that deal. Well, when you take a deal, or there's a sentencing. So they scheduled a sentencing for April. Once they schedule a sentencing for a defendant, that prompts a probationary hearing. So what they do, or a probationary investigation. So then a probation department starts investigating the crime. They investigate what he did, how he did it, who he did it to. They talk to me, family members, witnesses, victims, like whatever. And they get a clear idea of what happened, because for every penal code crime, trust me, I've learned so much about the law. It's ridiculous. But every penal code in California has a three-tier punishment for it. It could be a light sentence because you're a first offender. It could be a medium sentence because you can't learn your lesson. Or it can be a really harsh sentence because there's special circumstances. Most people get sentenced, if they're a repeat offender, they're somewhere in the middle. But, you know, if there's special circumstances, they'll get a harsh penalty. Or if you get a really easy judge that day, you get a lighter sentence. But there's this leveled system. So part of the probationary department's job is to look at everything and go back to the judge and say, this is our report. This is what we recommend. Mild, medium, harsh, and why. So when we got to sentencing day, there's another little piece in here. On January 8th, we were supposed to go in the courtroom since he had gotten a deal and they were going to put it on record. And so we go in there and the judge comes out and he says, okay, so this is the matter of People versus Paul Fox. You're being charged with this crime and this crime. Do you understand these crimes? Yes. Do you plead guilty? Yes. Do you plead guilty to both? Yes. Whatever. This is your signature. Yes. Okay. But he came out and he's like, okay, so it sounds like she was 15, maybe 16. They had a relationship, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I'm sitting on the edge of my seat going, what is he talking about?
Yeah.
A relationship? I've never met this judge in my life. I'm supposed to be having a preliminary hearing. Now you've given him a deal and you're calling it a relationship. Like, I was livid. So we get out of there. It goes on record. We get out of there. He sets the sentencing for April. And I ended up calling him later. I called him and I said, I'm pissed. I am pissed. What the heck was that judge doing? He goes, hold on. It's like, he has to seem impartial, because if he doesn't seem impartial, then on sentencing day, the defendant can go, well, you were already against me or whatever. Mm. If he gives them like a harsher sentence or something, he goes, but remember that you're going to do a victim impact statement on sentencing day. And he's like, you're going to be the most important person in that room. That day is all about you. Tell the judge why you didn't like what he said. Tell him what happened, whatever. Okay, well, I spent the next 4 months doing just that. I did a 10-page victim impact statement. So we go to sentencing day. And before it ever gets started, we're sitting in there and I think it was the bailiff comes out and he tells them the judge wants to see counsel in chambers. So the DA and the defense, they go into chambers. Jerry comes out, he gets me, and I'm like, oh my God, what now? Because it felt like every time I went to court for something, it turned into something else. So, and we're several years in by now of going to court almost monthly. During COVID, it was every few months. So we go out into the hallway and he says, the judge is throwing out his deal. And I'm like, oh, he said he got the probation report. And the probation department recommended the harshest sentence for each one. And so he is changing his sentence to up to 18 months in prison. And jail is different than prison. If he goes to prison, supposedly that's harder. But so 18 months in prison and registered sex offender for life. And I said, okay, so that means he would serve like 9 months in prison because they always serve like half. I said, can we just say 2 years and call it a day? And he's like, no, there's no going back and forth. If he takes this deal, that will be his deal. Or if you don't like this, I will go tell him you want to go to trial. He said, keep in mind, because of COVID, you will go to trial in 2 years.
Ooh.
And I'm like, no, I'm done. Fine. The sentence is fine. Because at this point, it had been a couple years already, mm-hmm. and I was just done. So we go back in. They talk to the judge. He takes that new deal. And then, so we wait for them to enter that into paperwork and all that, whatever. So then we get started. And the DA had told me at some point, the judge will ask if you want to do a victim impact statement. That's when you say whether you do or you don't. And also keep in mind, there's media in there. There's cameramen, there's reporters, because this is the second person arrested from the same church. And so it's not just like you and your family in this room.
Yeah.
In this courtroom. So the judge comes out, it gets called to order, and he says, does the victim want to make an impact statement? And I'm like, dang, I'm like first. You know, so I'm like, all right. So I get up there and I start my victim impact statement. I started with, you know, my name. I knew there were parts I was going to cry through my victim impact statement. The first line of my 10 pages was, my name is Kathy Durbin and I am the victim in this case. And I started crying. Mm. And I knew I was in trouble because I cried through the next 10 pages. But initially, all I did was thank the DA, thank my investigator, Tony Pilato, for being amazing heroes that would help me get justice after 30 years, because by this time it was 30 years. And then I said, and I don't know verbatim what I said, but I basically said, Your Honor, on January 8th, you called what happened to me a relationship. It was not a relationship. And your words matter. I said, this victim impact statement is long. It's 10 pages. And I was told by the DA that I would be the most important person in this room. But I'm not, Your Honor. I'm not. You are. Because today, you get to decide what my innocence was worth. And so I read the next 10 pages, and I got done, and I went and sat down. And then the judge said something like, thank you for that. And then he said, counsel, I need to see you in chambers. And I'm like, what the fuck? I'm like, what? What is happening now?
What and so, a roller coaster.
I know. And so right in front of me is my investigator, and right next to her is my victim advocate. And they're both like, you're a badass. You did your job. And I'm like, but what does that mean? So a little while later, the judge comes back out. They call court to order again. And he said, in light of the victim impact statement, I was not aware of special circumstances in this case. So I am not sentencing this defendant because I'm not happy with the sentence I gave him. It's not enough. And so we will reschedule the sentencing.
Wow.
So I got the judge to change his mind.
That's amazing.
Which was phenomenal, because no one in that courtroom had ever seen a judge do that. The DA, the defense, the reporters, my victim advocate, no one. They all know that judges have the power to do that, but no one had ever seen it done, which I think was so amazing. He ended up getting, this was April, he ended up finally getting sentenced in September and went to prison. And it was just crazy to me that after 30 years that you could get justice.
Yeah. Are you able to say what the sentence was?
There were two charges. He got 2 years for each one, but he was able to serve them together.
Hmm.
Consecutively? No.
Concurrently?
Concurrently, yes. So he served them concurrently, and then he got out early for overcrowding because of COVID. So he spent less than a year, just under a year in prison. So, I mean, honestly, no amount of time would have been enough. Because I truly believe that victims of sexual abuse as a minor get a life sentence. It literally affects you the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So unless they're doing life in prison, which sometimes they do get that sentence, that it's just not enough. So you take what you can get. But there is power in the fact that someone says to you, and specifically someone in a position of authority, like a judge or a district attorney's office, says to you that you are worth justice, that this was wrong and this should not have happened. Because the adults in your life have failed you.
Yeah.
Your pastor, your person that represented God to you, failed you. And so there's something powerful to a girl that was abused and hearing that you deserve justice.
Wow. What an incredible story. I'm so glad that you were able to get that justice, because it's not very common.
Yeah.
And that you had to go through that, and 30 years later, wow, I'm sure you were thinking this was in the past, and then for it to just pop up like that again and to actually get that validation,
yeah,
I'm sure was so incredible. And now you're out telling your story. You're on this documentary, Let Us Pray, which everyone should go check out on HBO. And something that you said before was, I would love to talk on your podcast because now that I have a voice, I'm going to use it. And that's so powerful. Yes. So how Absolutely. Are you doing now? What's going on in your life? What makes you feel happy and at peace?
So I'm a nurse. I've been a nurse for 20 years this year. And I am actually in grad school to be a mental health nurse practitioner. Wow. I'm going to go into private practice and be a therapist. I feel like I want nothing more than just to help women, girls find their voice, because every time you tell your story, you're taking power, the power of that story that person has on you, you're taking a piece of it back.
Yeah.
And I think that the more you talk about it, the more you own it. It's yours. Even if it's a bad story, it's yours. And it kills the power that they have over you. And I just want so much. I look at the world and I see all these amazing women. They're raising amazing kids. They're running businesses. They're teachers. They're moms. They're wives. They're women are doing amazing things. And if you sit down and talk to them, a ton of them have a traumatic story that happened in their life at some point. And I feel like, man, if women are doing this from a place of trauma, what more could we do if we were healed?
Mm.
If we were on a path of healing, we could change the world. And so I want so desperately to do that. It's my goal when I'm done with school to open a retreat and have women come. And then I'm also getting ready to roll out a jewelry line that will be designed by survivors of abuse as minors. And every piece that's purchased, a minor now who was abused by someone will get a piece.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And that speaks to me specifically in that I wish just one adult in my life, just one that knew what had happened to me, would have come to me and said, this isn't your fault.
Yeah.
Or you're going to make it. Or you're loved. Or I'm sorry this happened to you. Or you're so strong for coming forward. And so I want these pieces to say those encouraging things to these minors that get them. I foresee facilitating that through like CPS, Child Protective Services, or the police department, or maybe emergency rooms, that they can give a piece to a child that's just been traumatized by someone and just let them hold on to that little message of hope and strength. And yeah. And then I'm hoping that jewelry line will then feed the retreat.
Yeah. It got me all emotional again. That's so beautiful. Aww. You have to let me know when that comes out and when that's going, yeah, because I would love to have you on again to talk about it and promote it.
Yeah, definitely.
It's just such a beautiful thing, this tangible thing that you can give someone to say that you matter and that somebody cares, yes, about you, I think can be all the difference in somebody's life. That's amazing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, well, before I just start going off and crying because I'm so pregnant and have my own story, of course, because follow the podcast, you know. But okay, is there anything else that you wanted to share before we sign off?
I don't think so. I mean, I just hope that people will keep reaching out and sharing their stories, and just, I love to hear from people that were touched in some way by my story. And I hope that everyone that's reached out so far will be excited about the jewelry line and just help get that going. So, because I'm really hoping that financially that will just feed the retreat and that people can come for free and just get healing. And I have these crazy ideas, but I hope they'll come to fruition.
Yes, it all sounds so great. Guys, if you want to contact her, her Instagram is MontanaMom4. And is there any other specific way that people can support you and support these goals that you have? Is there anything you're looking for?
I mean, if anyone knows anything about the jewelry business, that would be amazing because I am just trying to wing it. I'm fine with business. I know business because I owned a business, but like I know nothing about jewelry or how to facilitate that. Honestly, the best way to reach me is through my Facebook page or Messenger. I'm not on Instagram all that much, but I do go in every once in a while and check it. So Kathy Durbin. But yeah, definitely it'll be all over my personal pages when it's out.
Great. Well, with that, we just need your Linda Listen moment, your sassy statement, as the rabbit who with the toddler goes, or inspiration.
I think I'm going to go back to what I said in the, after the first podcast is just, Linda, listen, you have to find someone to tell your story because you cannot heal from something you are not allowed to talk about. And every time a woman shares her story, it's like she's reaching her hand out to another woman that needs to come be pulled out of that and share their story.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. Well, thank you so much again for coming on, Kathy, coming on twice. And yeah, you're a great storyteller. I feel like I was there the whole time, just captivated. I'm like, and then what happened? Oh. So thank you so much for coming on. And guys, if you want more context about the beginning of Kathy's story, please go back and watch the first episode. It will be linked in the description below, probably on the end screens or cards or something so you can find it. And I think that's it. Any other final thoughts?
No.
Okay.
Good. Thank you for having me on.
Yes, of course. And guys, if you're listening, I would love it if you could leave some comments down below, some words of encouragement. If you want to support the podcast, you can like, share, and comment. That's the best way. Or you can become a patron at patreon.com/cultstoconsciousness. You can check out our merch at cultstoconsciousness.com under the merch tab. You can come to Costa Rica with us. We're doing some fun adventurous things over there. There's about 6 spots left, and that will be in the description if you're interested. And I will link 2 videos down here below that you can check out. And until next time, follow your highest excitement, be conscious, and be well. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, it would mean a lot if you could like and subscribe on YouTube and leave a review or a comment to help with our visibility. You can also find me on social media at cults2consciousness or reach out by email at cults2consciousness@gmail.com.